When you think work, you think boots. You think boots, you think Ariat. You think grit, concrete, rain, and heat. And boots that never back down from any of it. You think comfort and durability that hold up on the job, off the clock, and every step in between. Because the day doesn't end when the job does. And from overtime to off-duty, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, and always back you up. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find yours at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
Don't sweat the technique.
You're listening to The Killer Bees with Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham
on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Broadcasting live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios.
Back on the Bees, two in the books, one to go. Final hour of the show is Brian McDonald and myself. We'll take you home up until 6 p.m. as Jeremy's off doing some cougar duties. And we were talking predominantly about our favorite baseball team here in the city and the fact that they are on the struggle bus to start the year. And I was watching the game last night, Brian, starting to think more about the fact that, as I mentioned earlier in the show, the main stories coming out of spring training and throughout spring training were Altuve and left, Cam Smith making the roster, and then, you know, what kind of impact he could possibly have. Now we have to add to that the fact that this offense as a whole is struggling mightily. And then starting to think about, when do we really panic? Because last year we kept holding hope alive until we had eulogies, until we buried this team, until we thought that, hey, we may never see success by the end of the this long haul that we call a major league season. They did find a way to win the division and then get bounced, which was good and then bad. When do we start pressing the panic button this season? Altuve in left. We know he's hitting the baseball again. We know he's a good hitter. He's the best hitter on the team again this year right now. But at a certain point with the play that happened last night that a lot of people are hyper-scrutinizing yet again, when do we start pushing the panic button on Altuve in left field in general? And from a fan base perspective, chime in here, guys. Like, when are you going to start being concerned about Altuve in left field? And is it going to be more about his defense or moving him back to second base with his offense and trying to find a better option like maybe DeCenzo in left field?
I'm definitely not there yet. Like, I think I made the reference to where it seems like we as Astros fans, because I do this at times too, but we react to every Astros game as if it has the same importance of a single Texans game. Mm-hmm. And if you were to think about a baseball season, it takes 10 games to be the equivalent of one, you know, NFL game. So, I mean, at what point would we freak out, you know, about a bad Texans stretch? I think probably 3 games. So I can't see myself freaking out about poor offensive numbers unless they just get so far behind that it gets to a point where it seems like they can't overcome it because they're so far back of whoever's leading the division. But I can't see myself freaking out about slow starts until we're at least 30 games in. I know the traditional time frame is usually Memorial Day. I'd allow myself for a little bit quicker hook than that, but at least 30 days.
All right, so specifically I started with Altuve and left because to me, we saw a little bit of maybe behind the scenes, not necessarily the panic button, but the fact that, hey, we realize right now that we're off to another slow start. How offensively do we do, or how do we reshuffle the deck to put our best offensive lineup out there, but maybe also be a little bit more leery of the fact that the defense is going to matter based on whether you want to base it on that play last night or just what they've seen. So Altuve making the move to second base when we were told pretty thoroughly throughout the spring training that he was going to be predominantly a left fielder. So maybe they are paying more attention to it. And when do you start being concerned enough to make that more of a regularity and move him back to second base than seeing him predominantly in left?
I mean, I do it now. And that's not necessarily because I'm panicking about him in left field. I mean, he's going to be bad in left field, but he's going to be bad in second base, as we've talked about, you know, ad nauseum. But, I mean, we have to remember, he had, 33 years of his life to learn how to play second base, and he's had one spring training plus now, 6 games mm-hmm. to learn how to play play left field. So I think it's maybe a bit of a rush to say he's got to be perfect now in left field if you're willing to see this experiment through. But I think I'd make the move now. Again, not panic, but just let's get our best offensive lineup in. Like, I'm not as concerned about defense right now when they're scoring one or two runs every single game. Yeah, like, let's get the best offensive lineup in there every single game. And if that's Altuve at second, so you can have Cam and Azenzo or whoever in the corner outfields, then so be it. Let's do it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think that I said even before camp started, and then based on what kind of camp he had, that DeCenzo was a guy that I thought could have an impact. If they didn't go out and get the bat that I wanted them to get in the offseason, then I want them to have their best offensive lineup out there, which obviously is a huge problem for them because, you know, only being able to muster 10 runs through 5 2/3 games this season is not good enough. And if individual players on different teams in Major League Baseball are putting up better numbers than your entire team offensively, then right now you might have to sacrifice even more defense to make sure that you have the best offensive lineup you can possibly have. You assume Christian Walker is going to snap out of it. You think that Paredes is a good enough offensive hitter that he's going, and he showed some signs that he's going to be all right. But DeCenzo in left, Smith in right, and honestly, Chaz in center, I'll live with the fact that Chaz maybe isn't Jake, but offensively Chaz is so much better than Jake that's the kind of lineup that I think that whether we're desperate or not completely, this seems like desperate times already offensively enough to at least for a series or a game or two to try the best offensive lineup you can possibly put out there.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I don't know if you've seen now, granted, this hasn't been updated for today. Baseball Reference doesn't update until I think the next day for a game. But I just pulled up. I was curious to see how bad these offensive numbers were. So I scrolled over and looked at the OPS plus category. Now, obviously, Altuve has been killing it. He had it under the hit. Unfortunately, they have first and third and still didn't bring a runner home. His OPS plus is great at this point. It's 10. I think this says 109. I can't quite make it. Yeah, 109. But you look at the rest of the guys in the OPS Plus, not only are they below 100, you have half your lineup in the negative, Joel. I mean, we have Yonder Diaz is negative 38, Christian Walker minus 13, Brendan Rodgers minus 7, Yordan, of all people, and we obviously know he started slow, is a minus 3, Jake Myers is a 16. I mean, not negatives, but I mean, we called Mauricio Dubon a bad offensive player because he has an OPS plus of 89, and you got half your lineup in the negatives right now. I think that points to your comment about desperation. I mean, it is just six games, but these offensive numbers are so bad that maybe trying out a desperate move is called for.
Well, and I think that, look, a lot of people said, well, your infield has to be better defensively. They brought in a former Gold Glove second baseman in Rodgers. Rodgers made an error today. Rodgers obviously cannot hit major league pitching on a consistent basis by any metrics that you're talking about looking at. And like I said, Granato was tweeting out what the overall
batting averages,
everybody's individual batting averages too, which are all hovering in the hundos and right around 100, which ain't going to get it done.
No.
So at this point, what do you have to lose that you wouldn't be already losing in terms of baseball games with how you've been doing it to this point? Why don't you just put out a absolute hell-bent offensive lineup and see if that doesn't snap you out of it and able to put up a crooked number in an inning or two to make people believe, hey, there still are good hitters on this team. And offensively, if we just kind of live and die by the sword, and in this case, the bigger bat, let's go with the fact that maybe that will help get them to score some runs, because right now it ain't cutting it. And I was like early in the, you know, in the Mets series going, okay, maybe they're going to play some more small ball this year. I'm okay with that. But that was under the assumption that the guys you brought in and the guys that you have that were already good hitters were all still going to hit. From the guys you brought in standpoint, I don't care how much Walker's barreling up the baseball. He's not hitting. Paredes is starting to show some signs, but he's not really hitting. And then a guy like Yordan, we just got done talking about, who is the centerpiece of everything you do offensively, isn't hitting. The only guy that is Altuve, so let's shuffle the deck.
Yeah, and just quickly, I misspoke. Altuve's OPS plus is actually 189, not 109.
Pretty damn good.
But again, everyone else is hovering barely above zero or in the negatives. And getting back to your point, like I completely agree. I'm willing to reshuffle. I mean, let's maybe play Altuve at second base, other than the days of Framber Valdez is on the mound. Let's, you know, try out DeCenzo and whoever else to see what this best offensive lineup is. The problem is, though, like, as much as we want to, you know, reshuffle, you know, everything around to get the best offensive lineup, it kind of feels like reshuffling, you know, chairs on the deck of the Titanic. Because how many spots are we really able to reshuffle to remake this lineup? I mean, one. We're talking about moving Altuve to second base that one additional person can move to the corner outfield. I mean, what change? As historically as bad as their offense has been through six games, changing out one person isn't going to be what fixes this, in my opinion.
But Brian, look, near, far, wherever you are, I completely believe that the offense will move on. I think it's more than one position. I think if you can put DeCenzo in left, you can put Chaz in center, you can put Cam Smith in right. Now you've completely
revamped
all three of those. You're going to put Altuve at second, where you at least have his offense that you just talked about in a spot where he's still in the lineup and hopefully doesn't hurt you too much. And then you go from there with a DH that's probably Caratini, or I mean it's Jordan, I'm sorry, with Jordan as DH, that's truly has the potential, at least on paper, to be better than what you've been throwing out there for six games.
Yeah, I forgot about the option of moving Chaz to center. I mean, it's definitely worth a shot. I'm not poo-pooing it, you know, the notion of trying it, because I think you should put your best offensive players out there, as bad as it's gone. I mean, even if it's two players instead of what I said earlier, one player, I don't know how much that changes or how quickly it changes it. Because honestly, I mean, most of these guys are just going to wake up. Christian Walker's a much better hitter than this. Obviously, Jordan Alvarez is a much better hitter than this. You know, Isak had a bad time in Chicago last year, but overall, he's been a much better hitter than this. So I do think these guys wake up before May. These aren't a bunch of Alex Bregmans who don't wake up until close to June. But overall, I don't know. I mean, they should put their best offensive lineup, damn the defense, but I don't know if it's going to make a drastic change quickly for them.
Let's take a break. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the fact from an offensive perspective and from what we heard coming out of camp, and it wasn't just specifically about Cam Smith or DeCenzo. There were things being spoken by your manager that echoed things that we had heard from your general manager that make you question more now than ever. Are they just blowing smoke up your hiney, or are they really telling you the truth about what they see, what they expect, and what they were going to do when the season started? Because right now I call BS. We'll talk about that when we come back. More Astros talk as we continue to roll on. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 FM.
ESPN 97.5. You found the Killer Bees, live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios. Here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Back on the Bees, Branham doing a little cougar work. So Brian and myself taking you up until 6 p.m. No, Paul. As we continue to roll on with Astros talk. Brian, we're getting on, you know, the topic of the hour in terms of when do you press the panic button and when are you concerned about things going on with the Astros right now. And as it relates to this team, as much as we were worried about Altuve and left and concerned about, you know, Cam Smith making this team and then how much he played, the biggest thing to me is that we heard from Dana, we heard from Espada, we were led to believe that, hey, if the young guys are going to make this roster, they're going to play. And, you know, up until the last two games, DeCenzo really hadn't even sniffed the opportunity with one game I think he had played. Cam Smith, I expected to see him out there basically every day, and that didn't happen. And I started thinking to myself, well, okay, Joe, well, what kind of bill of goods are you going to sell us next time, and how am I going to believe you? Because I believe right now, with as poor as the offense has been and the lack of production that they have been putting out there, that this offensive lineup that we just got done talking about as a potential possibility should be more a probability in terms of until they snap out of it offensively. And like you mentioned, Brian, some of the guys that we expect, like Walker and Paredes and Jordan, start picking it up, that you've got to do whatever you can to kind of jumpstart this offense. And that would be let these young kids eat, let them play.
Yeah, I mean, Cam's missed, what, one game out of six? So I'm not really upset about his playing time, but I'd like to see guys like DeCenzo get more of a chance. Mm-hmm. And like we talked about last segment, maybe Chaz is getting more starts in center field so he can get both Cam and DeCenzo in the lineup. I think this has to be kind of throw everything against the wall and see what sticks at this point. And again, not that it's a panic, because I mean, I'm not really trying to lock in an opinion that this is how the season's going to go until maybe 30 games or more, maybe even all the way up to Memorial Day. But, I mean, look, I mean, I mentioned it last segment, that, like, the OPS pluses for these guys, you know, negative 38 for Yiner, negative 13 for Christian Walker, Yordan's negative 3, Jake Meyers is 16. Like, the only guy that has a good one right now is Jose Altuve. He's literally the only guy of 9 that's hitting, or 8, 9 plus the DH. But, so, because of that, because of how bad the offense has been, throw everything up against the wall, see what sticks, and then find what lineup works for this team.
Now, but from the glass half full perspective, you know, it's always, and I've always been harping on the fact, it's not about winning like 10 games in a row. It's about winning series. You sure. Won the first series. You're going to lose the second series. So now you go on the road, and you can bounce back if you can fix the offense and beat the Twins and win that series. And I think that could start to kind of settle you down and right the ship. But offensively, I do have major concerns because one thing you did know is the middle of that lineup and the top five spots in that lineup was tough to top. Whether Bregman got off to a slow start or not, you still had Altuve and Yordan and Tucker at the front part of that lineup. And then Yiner, who everybody expected as starting last season, was just going to pick up where he left off on his rookie campaign and have power and average and do all the things that we kind of already have seen Yordan do. Instead, you are sitting there waiting for, and again, what we went through last year has so much to dictate and say about what we think this year. We're only two series in. We're going to split the two series, but because we've already been through Abreu at first base, the concern is Christian Walker might do exactly what Abreu did when he got here. And I heard some of that from some of the people that I've talked to about the fact that I have real concerns about Walker pulling an Abreu. Do you really? Because I mean, Abreu was at the end of the road, basically.
I mean, well, Christian Walker's 34. I mean, look, he's not what was Abreu when he got here? 36?
36.
So, going I mean, obviously, you know, I can do the math. That's 2 years difference in the favor of Christian Walker. But, I mean, Christian Walker, if let's say hypothetically, this is the beginning of a downward trend for his offense, he wouldn't be the first guy that, you know, hit the downside of his career at age 34. I don't think Christian Walker is going to be Jose Abreu. So don't hear what I'm not saying. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's going to have a poor offense season. I think he rebounds the exit velocities we've seen to, you know, starts to translate into more hits and things get back to kind of their average, their median by some point in the middle of the season. But it's not the craziest thing in the world to see that a 34-year-old guy is going to have an offensive decline.
But 6517 text in and says it's not just Abreu. We were burned by Trey Mancini too. So that's kind of like where I was going with this. From a team perspective, we saw a team that just absolutely crapped the bed last year for the first, as you said, the better barometer of about at least 30 games. Well, when they were 12-24, it was pretty close, and everybody was basically already writing their eulogy, as we did. But then you look at it and go, I've been there and done this before. Now I've got really sick feelings about if this team can do this another year. 2 years in a row when you know that it's very rare that they were able to do what they did last year and turn it around and win the division. From an individual perspective, if you've seen Abreu do this, if you already know that in a shorter sample size, Trey Mancini was another swing and a miss, is it fair to say that you already have PTSD to think that Walker is going to be a guy that falls right in line with that too, and the chances are greater than less that it could possibly happen? I believe Christian Walker is going to be just fine. I really do, and I believe Paredes is going to be just fine. But I understand it from a PTSD standpoint of we've already experienced this kind of stuff from a team and individual perspective so that we have these thoughts and they're justified.
Yeah, well, the Astros haven't found a first – I mean, they thought they did with the Abreu, certainly. They thought they at least put a Band-Aid on it with Mancini. But they haven't found a first base a guy that they trust since Yuli hit his decline and eventually exited the team. Now, I think Christian Walker coming into this year – was at a higher point in his career, closer to his prime than Jose Abreu or Trey Mancini were. Like those guys, I mean, Jose Abreu had come off a year where his home run totals dropped dramatically. Mancini's offensive numbers coming to the Astros obviously weren't what they, you know, were at his highest point of his career. So I think Christian Walker, at the time the Astros got him, was the best of those players as far as just pure offensive production. But again, I mean, he's 34. It's not insane to see that he would drop off. So I get the PTSD coming off of Mancini and Abreu. I don't think that's going to be the case, but I understand the mindset.
But you also understand that from the eye test perspective, and I know you guys are more analytical with a lot of the stats than me, but from the eye test perspective for all three of us, we can clearly see Walker has no problem catching up with a fastball.
No.
Abreu had a major issue with catching up to a major league fastball. And you could tell that his skills were diminishing rapidly. Whereas if you just take the Mets series, and last night, again, wasn't a great sample for him because he missed some pitches, and you could see he was visibly upset with himself. But he was barreling up balls in the Mets series. They just weren't falling, but the exit velocity, I think he hit two balls over 100 miles an hour off the bat that were just at people. So you know he can catch up with a fastball. You know he can still square it up, which is why I have a little less, maybe a lot less, concern than I would over Abreu for sure, and even Mancini once he got here.
Yeah, like, I mean, of all the guys that aren't Yordan that are struggling, Christian Walker is the second most, after Yordan is the guy I'm most confident is going to return to his career median, like be the guy that the Astros thought they were getting. Like, I have more confidence in him than even Yonder Diaz. Obviously, I have more confidence in him than Jake. I have more confidence in him than Pena or Brendan Rodgers. Like, Christian Walker has been a guy for, I mean, how long? I mean, but at least like the last 3 years when he was Arizona, just elite offensive production. I just pulled up his last few years in Arizona, 26-84, 33-103. 36 and 94. Those are his home runs and RBI the last 3 years in Arizona. That's a lead offensive player. And like you said, the kind of the analytics, the barrel rate, the exit velocity, all those point to signs of a guy making good contact. And he's a good player. And I don't think he's hit his decline. So I am confident that Christian Walker is going to be a guy that, you know, by if we had this conversation, what's today, April 2nd? If we have this conversation on May 2nd, Christian Walker is no longer someone that we're concerned about. But, you know, given the age, given the PTSD of things you mentioned like Mancini and Jose Abreu, I get why people would go there. I just don't think it's going to be the case for Christian Walker.
Now, the interesting thing that comes out of all this, too, is as much as we talked about Cam Smith coming into this season, would he make the team? Would he get these kind of consistent at-bats that we were wondering if we could believe Joe Espada and Dana Brown on? The question now becomes, because whether you say it's a high level of desperation or that they just are a little bit more panicky in terms of how do they fix the offense, is this a situation where, I don't know, and I'm interested from your perspective, Brian, would you rather have Cam just kind of fighting it out, getting these at-bats, trying to see what he can do in this lineup, or would you rather say, hey, at this point, it might be better for Cam to start feasting on minor league pitching, keep his confidence up, and realize that at a certain point, you will bring him back?
I don't want to give him – I think this would be too quick of a hook. I get the idea of, you know, regular bats, get his confidence a bat. I get that thought. But I think pulling – or, like, sending him to Sugarland after six games would have a negative –
and I'm not saying, like, tomorrow – but I'm saying if this is the plan or if it's going to play out where he's not going to play really consistently.
I mean, he's played 5 out of 6. That's consistent to me. If he plays 5 out of every 6, he's going to be
fine.
A guy
that's
plays, you know, 100. I don't know what the math would work out to, but 145 plus.
Yeah, it's just to me, the only thing that I'm worried about is that his long-term success is so huge for you as an organization that we know that guys coming up for the very first time, like Bregman, like others, they have a tendency to struggle, and you need to be kind of concerned about that. I'm not worried about Cam Smith yet. I'm like you, but I have heard from people that have said, you know, maybe what we had a conversation about a week or so ago, maybe you guys were right. Maybe the fact that he's barely played minor league baseball coming out of Florida State, maybe that matters, and he's so valuable to this team that maybe it is more important for him to get minor league at-bats and kind of feast on minor league pitching like he did in training camp. It's just, to me, there's no other options. For your outfield right now, there's no better options for sure than Cam Smith, and there's no more power hitting options or better average hitting options because Jake's not that guy.
Yeah, that's why I wouldn't make the decision right now with Cam Smith. Like, while there's still a thought that this team could get to a point where, you know, it contends or it could win a division – Cam Smith's your best option in right field. So I'm not going away from that. I mean, the evaluation on him from what we saw in spring training, obviously for the team, what they saw in spring training, was this guy could handle, you know, the major league level, even though he'd only played five games above the single A level. You know, obviously that was a risky move. That was a move that seemed very, very quick to a lot of folks. But if they felt he could handle it, I'm not giving him the hook after six games, especially like you said, there's no better option in right field. Like if you give Cam Smith the hook and send him to AAA, to play who? I mean, maybe it's DeZinzo, maybe it's Chaz on an everyday basis. But those guys haven't. I mean, Chaz has hit fine, but they're not guys that I'd be rushing to move your Uber prospect out of right field for. I mean, I'd rather give, you know, I don't know how long it would be. Maybe it's May, maybe it's June, maybe it's more dependent upon where they are in the division, and maybe that is what makes your decision ultimately. But I'm not moving Cam Smith taking away this opportunity until he proves, like, without a doubt he can't do it, or the division race gets completely away from them.
See, that's the thing to me, is you look at it and say, what is the big enough sample size to be able to determine that Cam Smith either is getting it or not? Because they were very, very patient with Alex Bregman. You know,
yeah,
Alex Bregman struggled mightily.
2 for 30 or whatever it was.
And they just kept rolling with him. So I think it also has to be factored in that as an entire offense, they're not hitting. They're not doing anything to, you know, set up at bats for him or make anything easier too. And the offense is struggling as a whole. I think it's pretty unfair to, like, be critical of Cam Smith at this point. The question is, when do you think it's fair to be critical of Cam Smith?
Again, not to go back to the exact same number I said before, but I still think it's about 30 games. Like, I mean, 30 games would be, like I continue to try to put it through the football lens just because I think it gives perspective to how little of a season we're freaking out about. But, I mean, 30 games would be about three games in the NFL, and I think that's, you know, kind of a large enough sample size at times to kind of see if guys are getting it enough, or at least to know if, you know, what trajectory they're on. Not that you can entirely, you know, obviously map out a guy's season off of three games, but I'm not really – I don't think I could be talking to making a move with Cam Smith until at least 30 games. And even that might be kind of a small sample size. But if it's 30 games and they're way behind the division, then I might start to look towards, you know, making a move if he's hitting poorly. But I can't imagine making a move before 30 games.
I think it's longer than that for me. And I think it's primarily because I don't see a better option to put out there.
So what would your day be? Like Memorial Day? Is that the kind of that classic time frame?
I think mid-June. I think I'm rolling with
it. I'd be fine with that. That was like 30 days is really just my minimum.
I'm not totally confident that I want to do it, because you look at teams that have had high-rated prospects in the past that weren't very good. The season,
Kyle Tucker got sent down multiple times.
And you look at some of the Nationals teams and some of the Royals teams and some of the teams where they had high-ranked prospects. They were awful as a team, and the actual players were struggling early. But the experience was so valuable to their overall long-term success that you just rolled with them and knew that, like you said, that because they felt confident he could handle everything mentally, that he wasn't going to get down on himself or start questioning his abilities, that you kind of end up prospering in for it in the big picture anyway. So maybe that factors in too, but I think by All-Star break is when I would really be seriously concerned if he was still struggling. But by mid-June, I'm thinking that's when I'm going to start really considering.
Yeah, the only caveat I would give to that is where they are in the division. Like, I mean, and I think it'd be impossible to say that the division's getting away from them after 30 games. But, you know, sometime mid-May, sometime early June, if it's getting to a point where it was last season where they're like 10 games behind Seattle or whoever's in first, then, you know, maybe I'm – because I'm with you. Like, half a season is reasonable. But I think where they are in the division and what else, you know, maybe Jacob Melton has a great, you know, whatever. Or maybe another option emerges. If the division's getting away from them and another option emerges and Cam Smith is struggling in that sort of perfect storm, then I'd be willing to make a move earlier. Otherwise, you're right. I think it's probably sometime in June or July.
All right. Let us know what you think. 713-780-3776. We continue to kick some Astros around. Let's talk some Rockets and get some positives in here. Rockets hosting the Jazz tonight, another game that they should win. Currently the number 2 seed in the Western Conference. The question then becomes, you know, is this enough? If they finish with the number two seed in the West, is this season a success? Because there are people out there talking for other teams out there saying that the teams are lining themselves up because they want the Rockets in the first round at any time in the playoffs because they think that that is an easy path to victory. We'll continue to kick it around on the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 FM.
Do you have the ESPN Houston app? No? Then download it now in your app store. Broadcasting live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, it's the Killer Bees with Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
On ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Back on the Bees, Branham doing some Coug work. So B-Mac and I take you home until the top of the hour at 6 p.m. where soccer matters and Glenn Davis will have all kinds of football on the agenda starting from 6. 7 o'clock will be the Hall of Fame with Brad and Booker T, and Comicast at 8 with Zhong Li and our good friend Michael Carroll. But I threw it out there before the break, B-Mac. We probably need to break from the negativity that's centered around the Astros right now. Your Rockets are the 2 seed, and the Denver Nuggets did you a massive favor last night by Russell Westbrook peeing down his leg on 2 plays in double overtime. The Timberwolves beating the Nuggets, and what seemingly is a 3-team race to get and solidify the 2 seed. Seems like the Rockets are back in the driver's seat more so than ever, leading the Nuggets and the Lakers by a minimum of 2 games. But I throw the question out to you because watching the national broadcast, it's always, of course, different than what we see on a night-by-night basis with the Rockets. If they lock up the 2 seed, if they're sitting there with the second-best record in the West right behind the red-hot Oklahoma City Thunder, is that the progress that we needed to see to say another successful season? Because honestly, and I mentioned this from a national perspective, there are people that love Amen Thompson. They love the youth of the Rockets. But in the same breath, they're also saying, but if they run into the wrong matchup or most of the matchups in the Western Conference, this team is going to get beat in the first round. And I'm curious your thoughts in terms of what is a successful season for the Rockets, and are you concerned about what some of these national guys are saying?
I mean, yeah, I wouldn't pick them in all the possible matchups. Like, I don't think they face the Warriors at this point. The Warriors have, I think, put themselves in a spot where it's probably not them, although it's pretty tight there for 5 and 6 with the Warriors. Well, and the Grizzlies, too. Like, there's certainly a few teams I would not pick them to defeat in the first round. But, overall, I think it's a successful season. I mean, going from 41-41 to the second seed in the West, it's hard to say it's anything other than a successful season. But I think there is going to be a need to be a little bit of context on it. Like, I think overall, in most cases, I would say no matter what happens in the playoffs, successful season. You have a group of players who are all, you know, like, the core players other than, you know, Fred and Dylan, who are, you know, around the age of 22, just barely been old enough to drink, to get them from, you know, a 20-something win season to 41 and now up to the second seed is obviously very successful. But if they lose in 5 games to, let's just say, the Mavericks right now, who are currently the 9th seed, let's say the Mavericks come out of the play-in and you face the Mavericks in the first round and they beat you in 5 games, hypothetically, I obviously do not think that would happen. It'd be hard at that point for me to say great season when the Mavericks, you know, obviously with all that's gone on with their season, trading out Luka and the injuries that have surrounded that team, it'd be hard for me to say in that situation after that, you know, hypothetical 5-game series loss to the Mavericks that it's still great, successful season. But otherwise, outside of that, yes.
See, I'm not going to say great, but I think it's a successful season no matter what, because I don't think in my wildest dreams, and I had them in the play-in, that I would have thought that they would have the second-best record in the Western Conference. Same. I think that the barometers are different from year to year, and you're obviously not going to do what Ime was able to do in his first year in every season and improve by 22 games and make this massive.
Yeah, they would have had to get to,
right?
63,
yeah,
this year.
And
that
to win
that wasn't
50
possible.
Games, which they're on pace to do, and to get the second seed in the West are both major accomplishments. And the reason why, even if they got bounced in the scenario that you provided, and I'm looking at the play-in teams, I'm concerned if they would end up playing Dallas. I'm concerned if they would end up playing Phoenix. As bad as Phoenix has been, if Kevin Durant's ankle isn't completely out of whack, and he's supposed to be back next week. But you could still have the potential of them saying, you know what, we have playoff experience between Booker, Beal, and Durant.
I don't know. Like, I'm with you for most of that, but, I mean, Kevin Durant got hurt, what, like midway through the third in that game the Rockets beat
him
by,
like,
40?
Yeah, they were up big, right? But I think that the regular
Booker
season...
Booker was playing, like, I don't fear the Suns at all.
I just think that even the Suns, and the reason why I'm saying all this is because this is why I would deem it a success. You look at all these other teams. If Minnesota ends up a play-in team, Minnesota showed you last night that as long as they have Anthony Edwards, they have a chance against anybody. And we saw that last year when it would essentially came down to Anthony Edwards versus Luka Doncic. So I think that they have a star. The Mavs, even without Kyrie, still have Anthony Davis, which is one of the top 10 players in this league when you look at all NBA from year in, year out. And when he's healthy, he's playing at a level like very few can play. We hope Jalen's that guy. We think Şengün could be that guy. But neither guy has proven that. So at least the teams that you're facing are going to come in with a go-to stud type player that could do you in almost single-handedly, no matter what you throw at them. So I'm concerned, even from a play-in perspective, like if they get one of those teams that, say three of the four teams, if it's Memphis that slides all the way down, even with all the disarray of firing their coach, with Ja, with Jaren Jackson Jr., and Bane, do I believe that they could beat the Rockets? I do.
See, I couldn't go there. Like, I would be with you on Minnesota. They have a singular star that's better than anyone on your team. And I'd go there with the Warriors because, well, one, they...
Steph had 52 last
night. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, one, they have Steph. Obviously, Jimmy Butler's been reinvigorated. And they just have your number. So I'm completely with you. If they face the Warriors or the Timberwolves in round one, I probably am picking the other team. And I wouldn't be upset if they lost to them. I don't think I could go there... With the Grizzlies, or certainly the Suns, or even the Mavericks. Like, I mean, Anthony Davis is a great player, but outside of Jokic, I just don't fear, like, a team that's so dependent on one post player. Like, Anthony Davis is not going to go off for 50 and beat you.
No,
like,
but
it's going to take the rest of the Mavs roster to beat you.
They got to be healthy, but they got two bigs that are very, very capable with.
I know. I just, like, outside of, okay, so if you were to stack the two rosters, mm-hmm. you know, Rockets and Mavericks, you know, let's say Anthony Davis is number one for this mm-hmm. conversation. Mm-hmm. How many of the next, like, how many, if you were to go 1 through 10, like, how many of those players are Rockets players? I think a majority of them.
I think, then I go, look, Clay is not Clay, but Clay has veteran playoff experience. That you have guys that are still capable, but they have experience with veterans like Thompson and Davis, as opposed to guys like Brooks and Van Vliet. You're right. The in terms of, like, 1 through 10, top 10 guys in a series, do the Rockets have more talent? Probably. But I think experience matters in the playoffs, too. So I look at that and I say, that's not a cakewalk for them.
No.
And as the
no,
two seed, it probably should be.
Yeah, I don't want to get wrapped up in what it should be, but I'm with you. As
most seasons, though, the two seed is expected to beat the seven.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess it depends on what you define as a cakewalk. Like, if they took that series in six, I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't bat an eye at it. I wouldn't view that as a disappointment. Now, if it came down to games, like, if it was a seven-game series and every game was grueling and they, like, felt like they played down to their competition, quote-unquote, then maybe, you know, you could say a win of the series isn't impressive. But I don't know. I don't think I would nitpick a series win. And, I mean, going back to my comparison of, like, top 10 players, how many are in the Rockets? I think it might be as much as 7 of the 10 if you were to take the best players in that series. I mean, you know the NBA more than I do, so I'll defer. But I couldn't see the Mavericks winning that series against the Rockets.
I give them a puncher's chance, and I think that's scary when you talk a 2-7. Because I think that where this conversation started to, if I just told you that, and they win one series in the playoffs, now I think unequivocally, no matter what they do after that, is icing on the cake. But if they get bounced in the first round, there's going to be a lot of people that, as the 2 seed, are going to be highly disappointed that this team didn't go farther and do more. And I honestly think that's unfair.
I do, too, because I think the context is needed to say, well, you're a 2 seed and you got bounced in the first round. Like, the only spot where there's a huge gap is Oklahoma City to the rest of the Western Conference. I mean, there's a huge gap there. They had the conference locked up, you know, a while back. Mm-hmm. But when you look at, you know, 2 through 6, and maybe even as far down as you got teams like Minnesota currently in the play-in, there's not a ton of games separating those teams. I mean, yes, it's 2-7 or whatever, but if the difference in the standings is 4 games, are those teams really like that far apart? So outside of losing to, you know, like go back to the hypothetical against Dallas, that would be a disappointment to me. So would losing to Memphis, who you won the Rockets won the season series against. Obviously, losing to the Suns would be a disappointment after you just, you know, killed them by 40 or whatever a couple of nights ago. But if they lost to the Warriors or they lost to, you know, Anthony Edwards and the Timberwolves, as long as they were competitive in the series and, you know, they didn't get beaten, you know, 4 or 5, I wouldn't view that as a bad season.
See, I think that the scary thing to me is that the potential for the play, and the, as it sits currently, the Timberwolves, Clippers, Mavs, and Kings would be in the play-in. Other than the Kings, and the Kings still have some firepower with having made the trades for DeRozan and LaVine, along with assuming Sabonis is back, I think the potential is there for the Rockets to lose to 3 of those 4 teams quite easily.
So everyone other than the Kings?
Everyone other than the Kings, I believe that the Rockets have a legit chance of losing to, and as the 2 seed, that's what would scare me, and that's where I fear that people are going to be highly critical of this team. Because I think that as long as they solidify the 2 seed, and that, like I said, they have right now they have 27 losses, Denver's got 29, Lakers have 29, Rockets still play both of those teams with a chance to win the tiebreaker. I just believe that the Rockets winning as much as they've done this year, winning 50-plus games, solidifying the 2 seed, that's enough for me to say this season is a success, even if they would lose to a play-in team in the first round of the playoffs.
Yeah, so if they play the Jazz tonight, right? Mm-hmm. So if they win tonight, they'd be up at least two games with 3 to go or with 6 to go against the Nuggets. I mean, it's starting to. I don't know if the Nuggets play also, so let's just say it's 2.5. It's starting to, and I know that there's a game remaining against Denver. But I think if a win tonight puts it in a spot where it starts to feel like this 2 seed is close to a lock, not a mortal lock, but a close to lock. Mm-hmm. But getting back to your overall point, like, I mean, I'd fear a Clippers team if you could tell me Kawhi is definitely going to be healthy. But
I'm not good.
I know, but I'm just not going to bank on Kawhi being healthy. We know James's track record. Hello, Manu Ginobili's block against him way back in the day.
Or refusing to shoot for over.
Or refusing to shoot, or, you know, getting benched and then getting Kevin McHale fired for it. Like, looking at those playoff teams, I mean, I see your point, but like the only team of those 4 playoff teams that are currently playing teams that I would fear would be the Timberwolves. I mean, I see the path for the Clippers to beat you if Kawhi's healthy. And you know, I guess you can make the point of Anthony Davis plays Superman, but I don't know. I don't fear the Mavericks. Obviously, I don't really fear the Kings. And
that's fair.
I've seen the James Harden show. I've seen the Kawhi Leonard gets hurt show too many times to currently, you know, as what I know now, fear the Clippers.
Well, we'll see what happens. Rockets and Jazz tonight, as Vernon Maxwell, I'm sure, will be tweeting up a storm about his favorite team.
Oh, yeah. Hates
the Utah Jazz. Yeah. Hopefully the Rockets get another victory. That would be 50 on the season with them having more wins in their future. I probably was wrong when the fact that I thought they would be right at 50 and not get to 53 or 54. But look, if they win 50 games, that's another reason why they should have success. All right, we got 1 segment to go on the show. We're going to wrap it up next with what we'd always do, car wreck of the day. If you guys got car wrecks you want to get in, 713-780-3776. Call, text, hit us on social media. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 FM.
John and Lance, weekday mornings from 7 to 10.
God, we should just put all the dumb people in a... Just put them in one state. And just,
well,
just,
somebody
I'm
got
tired it. Of these dummies.
What if
I kept using it because I thought it was a skin irritation.
You could get diarrhea. Oh, yeah. What is diarrhea? When you poop soup. Honestly.
You all right?
My leg is broken. The bone's coming through.
You prick! Where's my money?
This is the car wreck of the day.
Well, you know how we do it as we wrap up the show every single day. What is your car wreck and why? Brian, kick us off.
All right, in an express edition here of Car Wreck Today, as Tupac has already hit the airwaves, I'm going to go with Russell Westbrook, who was laying up some bricks and wasted a 60-point performance from Jokic last night. And apparently try to get some fans kicked out for
missed the layup,
for using the Westbrook name,
fouled a 3-point shooter to lose the game, and then got into it with a fan on the way off the court.
Yeah, try to get him kicked out because he apparently disrespected his family name and called him Westbrook. Just completely soft there from Crazy Russ.
And mine goes to the unfortunate situation in Atlanta last night. A fan was picked off out of the stands to have a layup competition to win prizes. Instead, on his way to the basket, he slipped, he fell, he tore his ACL.
Ooh, yikes.
Ouch. And I hope the Hawks do
We don't have time to discuss liability, but that fascinates me.
I hope the Hawks do him solid on that one. All right, that'll do it for us. Soccer Matters coming up next with Glenn Davis. You're not going to want to miss that. For Brian McDonald, I'm Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham off doing Cougar stuff. We'll all be back in tow tomorrow. We'll look forward to talking to you then right here on the Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 FM.
The best in Houston sports talk is ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.